Morning, everybody. Last week, I counted that there were around about 20 children not here that would normally be here. So I want to start this morning by saying what a joy it is to see you back again. Oh, I missed you last week. Apart from Megs. Megs, you were here last week, weren't you? Yes, you were. Yeah. Crumbs, you can say the wrong thing so easily, can't you? If you were here, you will remember that Andy preached on Deuteronomy chapter 7, which means to say that by process of elimination, this week we're going to be looking at Deuteronomy chapter 8 and chapter 9. So I'm going to read you Deuteronomy chapter 8. If you've got your Bibles with you, perhaps you'd like to follow on your Bible. Just give you a minute to find it. Verse 1 then. The whole commandment that I command you today, you shall be careful to do, that you may live and multiply and go in and possess the land that the Lord swore to give to your fathers. And you shall remember the whole way that the Lord your God has led you these 40 years in the wilderness, that he might humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. And he humbled you and let you hunger, and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know that man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord. Your clothing did not wear out on you, and your foot did not swell these 40 years. Know then, in your heart, that as man disciplines his son, the Lord your God disciplines you. So you shall keep the commandments of the Lord your God by walking in his ways and by fearing him. For the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land, a land of brooks of water, of fountains and springs flowing out of the valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley, of vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive trees and honey, a land in which you will eat bread without scarcity, in which you will lack nothing, a land whose stones are iron and out of whose hills you can dig copper. And you shall eat and be full, and you shall bless the Lord your God for the good land he has given you. Take care lest you forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments and his rules and his statutes, which I command you today, lest when you have eaten and are full, and have built good houses and live in them, and when your herds and flocks multiply, and your silver and gold is multiplied, and all that you have is multiplied, then your heart be lifted up, and you forget the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, which led you through the great and terrifying wilderness, with its fiery serpents and scorpions and thirsty ground where there was no water, who brought you water out of the flinty rock, who fed you in the wilderness with manna that your fathers did not know, that he might humble you and test you to do you good in the end. Beware lest you say in your heart, my power and the might of my hand have gotten me this wealth. You shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you power to get wealth, that he may confirm his covenant that he swore to your fathers, as it is this day. And if you forget the Lord your God and go after other gods and serve them and worship them, I solemnly warn you today that you shall surely perish. Like the nations that the Lord makes to perish before you, so shall you perish, because you would not obey the voice of the Lord your God. God will bless his word to us. Well, welcome to Deuteronomy chapter 8. Do you know what? I don't remember ever having so much trouble preparing a sermon in the whole of my life. And it's not because there's not enough to say. The problem in looking at chapter 8 and chapter 9 for me this week has been, what do I put in and what do I leave out? There is just so much there. How can you possibly preach on Deuteronomy 8 and 9 and not talk about that precious verse about the word of the Lord and the fact that we grow by his word and not just by ours? You know these words because Jesus used them, didn't he? There's so much there. How can you preach on this without talking about so many great truths that are there? Well, I'm sorry if I can't deal with it all. There just isn't enough time. But on reading 8 and 9, the first time, at least the first time last week, two words just jumped out at me. The words remember and forget. I'm not really going to be preaching on that today, but nevertheless, these two words are really important. And I'm just going to run through them again from chapter 8. In verse 2, it says, "You shall remember the whole way that the Lord your God has led you these 40 years in the wilderness." Verse 11 says, "Take care lest you forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments." Verse 14, "Then your heart be lifted up and you forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery." Verse 18, "You shall remember the Lord your God, for it's he who gives you power to get wealth, that he may confirm his covenant that he swore to your fathers as it is this day." And then in verse 19, "And if you forget the Lord your God and go after other gods and serve them and worship them, I solemnly warn you today that you shall surely perish." Goes on into chapter 9 as well. And in verse 7, you find both words, remember and forget. Remember and do not forget how you provoked the Lord your God to wrath in the wilderness. From the day you came out of the land of Egypt until you came to this place, you've been rebellious against the Lord. So lots of stuff about remembering and not forgetting. But I want to look at two things this morning. They both start with "don't be fooled." The first one says, "Don't be fooled. The wilderness may turn out to be a place of great blessing." And the second, "Don't be fooled. The mountaintop may turn out to be a place of hidden peril and a trap to the unwary." Back in the day when I first became a Christian, there were two analogies that were often referred to when you spoke to people. They would say, if you're going through a really difficult time, if everything is hard for you right now, then you're going through a wilderness experience. And if everything was going really well, and you were literally on top of the world, then people would say, "Oh, you're having a mountaintop experience." And I want to remember that analogy as I go through the rest of what I have to say this morning. So don't be fooled. The wilderness may well turn out to be a place of great blessing. Let's start by saying and by acknowledging that the experience that the Israelites are going through, that they've been going through for the last 40 years, has not been pleasant for them. They've escaped from Egypt by the mighty hand of God, and they've then found themselves in a place that they considered to be so horrible that they actually wish they could be back in Egypt again. Now, it seems to me that such an attitude was nuts, to say the least. Corporate amnesia at its most powerful, yet still the wilderness was a really unpleasant place to be in many respects. It was often compared to a desert. It was a dangerous place with little food or water to be found. The people had left Egypt with such high hopes, but they'd quickly turned to complaining. And soon they turned on Moses with the words, "Is it because there are no graves in Egypt that you've taken us away to die in the wilderness? What have you done to us in bringing us out of Egypt? Is not this what we said in Egypt? Leave us alone, that we may serve the Egyptians. For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness." So the wilderness was a place of dread and deprivation. But in all honesty, it couldn't really be said that the wilderness was worse than Egypt, where little boys were routinely slaughtered by the authorities. But it really, was it as bad as Egypt had been? Was it as bad as the Israelites seemed to think it was? Well, in some respects, I guess it must have been. But even in such a situation, if they would only admit it to themselves, there were incredible blessings that are highlighted here in Deuteronomy 8. Let me just read you three of them. "The Lord has led you these 40 years in the wilderness. He fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know. Your clothing did not wear out on you, and your foot did not swell these 40 years. If only they'd had eyes to see and a willingness to acknowledge the facts, the people of Israel could have appreciated how great was God's love and his provision for them, even in difficult circumstances." So I want to say to some of you this morning, some of you who may perhaps have been moving in desert places for what seems to have been years, perhaps even in your circumstances, there may be precious blessings that can't be found or appreciated elsewhere. Not that the wilderness may become anything other than a wilderness, but that blessings may be found even there. Special blessings that should be remembered and not forgotten. "The Lord your God has led you these 40 years in the wilderness." You would agree with me, I'm sure, that it's a wonderful thing to know the assurance of God's blessing. To get up in the morning and know that God's going to go with you today, whatever today holds. To remember that yesterday, that same God was with you every moment and you were never alone. A wonderful thing to know the assurance of God's presence, whether it be in a wilderness or even in the valley of the shadow of death. As God's people, you and I are never alone. God is always with us, whatever stage of life we're in, and he will never abandon us, and we will never be abandoned by him. I read these chapters in Deuteronomy, and I have to admit that my first reaction quite often is, wow, really? They take me by surprise. They go against my natural way of thinking. To my lazy way of thinking, they're strange. Why would I want to remember the pain of the past? Why is it helpful to remember difficult times? Why not just think about the present blessings? What's happening now? We'll take a closer look. My natural inclination, if I'm honest, is to do my very best to forget the difficult times, because they bring back memories of my weakness and my failure, my pain and my own tendency to sin. It's much easier, so much easier to remember the good times. When I'm in my old people's home, scarily getting closer every day, I think, I imagine I'll be thinking about the good times there in my room, thinking about having worked with local kids in Africa and India and Eastern Europe. I imagine I'll be remembering great meals with local people and sometimes great restaurants. I'll be remembering churches crammed with people and every seat taken, great company and exceptional people. Those incredible moments that appear to be the most wonderful times of my life. Yet, actually, I know that that won't be the case. In actual fact, I know that in reality, those aren't the most precious times at all, great as they were. There's a danger there. There's a danger there to sin, self-congratulation, and complacency. The things that will be most sustaining in the days ahead, the greatest blessing, really, because they speak of God's goodness, forgiveness, sustaining power, and steadfast love, will be those times when I've felt scared, when I felt alone, when I felt weak and a failure, and really pretty much a waste of space, because at those times, God has stepped up and done stuff that actually had nothing to do with me and everything to do with the grace of God. And as the Israelites look back on their time in the wilderness, there were things there that spoke to them so clearly of the goodness and greatness of God. The wilderness experiences that we've all known, that maybe we're going through even right now, or will go through in the future. Those times are when many of the props that we depend upon are ripped away and we learn to depend on God alone. When we realize that our strength is just nowhere near enough, that our strength is pretty much non-existent, but God's strength is everything. When human strength and ingenuity, the kindness of friends and the best a benevolent state can offer fail. And God steps in, unmistakably God, like when he provides bread in a desert land, when clothes that have been worn for decades refuse to wear out, when feet that should refuse to take another step, nevertheless just keep on plodding on with no ill effects whatsoever, despite the difficulties of the road. When our weakness and frailty urge us to give up, I can't go on, I'm hungry, my feet hurt, I've nothing to wear, and God says, let me deal with that, let's go. When we step outside of our own limitations and find that God has no limitations. And all these millennia later, when Jews celebrate the great festivals of their faith, they don't just celebrate the mountain's tops, but they celebrate the wildernesses too. Why? Because they discovered things about God there and about themselves there in the wilderness that they could never have found on the mountaintop. Why would God have needed to provide manna if they could eat steak and chips or their vegan alternative? Why happy feet if the chiropodist fees were well within their reach? Why clothes that lasted decades if they could afford a new set every time that fashion dictated? All of these blessings that they discovered in the wilderness that they would never have known on the mountaintop. For Jewish people, the wilderness remains a wilderness, always deeply unpleasant. But nevertheless, they rejoice in the discovery that they made about the God who accompanied, or rather led them through those difficult years. I want to say this to you brothers and sisters. And actually, it's really quite difficult to say because you are very dear. There are people in our church who at this very moment are going through terrible, awful wilderness experiences. You could put names to them. I can't begin to understand how they must feel sometimes. Difficult, difficult wilderness times. I would love to say that I would take your pain if I could, but I know I'm not brave enough. But this I do know, without a shadow of doubt. There are things about God that you have or will have discovered in the agony of your particular wilderness that I have never known. You have discovered things about God in those wilderness experiences that some of us have never known. And they're very precious, very precious. And to the Jews of Deuteronomy 8 and 9, and to you, God says, remember, never forget. You shall remember the whole way that the Lord your God has led you these 40 years in the wilderness. And so I say to you, keep records. All these years I've been saying to you, in the good times, keep records, they'll carry you through the weak times. It's not what the scripture says here in Deuteronomy 8 and 9. It says this. It says, in the wilderness times, in the difficult times, in the painful times, in the times when you feel lost and alone, keep records, because those times will keep you and protect you in the dangers of the mountaintop years. It's not the way I've ever thought about it before until I read Deuteronomy 8 and 9. To Moses' generation, their experience was a time of testing and humbling and a time of self-discovery. And the most precious discovery was that despite their egregious sin, God still remained God. And he still kept his promises despite the fact that they deserved nothing, nothing at all but condemnation and destruction from him. Let me read you a few verses from chapter 9, starting at verse 6. Know therefore that the Lord your God is not giving you this good land to possess because of your righteousness, for you are a stubborn people. Remember and do not forget how you provoked the Lord your God to wrath in the wilderness. From the day you came out of Egypt until you came to this place, you've been rebellious against the Lord. Even at Horeb, you provoked the Lord to wrath, and the Lord was so angry with you that he was ready to destroy you. When I went up the mountain to receive the tablets of stone, the tablets of the covenant that the Lord made with you, I remained on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. I neither ate bread nor drank water. And the Lord gave me the two tablets of stone written with the finger of God. And on them were all the words that the Lord has spoken with you on the mountain, out of the midst of the fire, on the day of the assembly. And at the end of 40 days and 40 nights, the Lord gave me the two tablets of stone, the tablets of the covenant. So I turned and came down from the mountain, and the mountain was burning with fire. And the two tablets of the covenant were in my two hands. And I looked, and behold, you had sinned against the Lord your God. You had made yourselves a golden calf. You had turned aside quickly from the way the Lord had commanded you. Do you see the horror of this moment, brothers and sisters, at the very instant that God is establishing his covenant with Moses, at the very moment that the relationship between a loving and compassionate God and his disobedient people is being ratified, those same people are committing what is sometimes known as the great apostasy, creating a golden calf and worshipping and sacrificing to it in the most terrible way. Look at how they'd been blessed before this, the escape from Egypt. And after plagues of water and blood, frogs and gnats, flies and dead cattle, boils, hail, locusts and darkness, after the angel of death and divine protection, after pillars of cloud and fire directing them, after the crossing of the Red Sea and the destruction of the Egyptian army, even as the covenant is being communicated, Aaron and the fathers and mothers of these people standing before Moses in Deuteronomy 9 are doing a terrible thing. Exodus 32 tells us that the people, and this is the most amazing thing, Exodus 32 tells us that the people even attribute their escape from Egypt to the gods they had created. And the Lord said to Moses, go down, for your people who you've brought up out of the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves. They've turned aside quickly out of the way that I commanded them. They've made for themselves a golden calf and have worshipped it and sacrificed to it and said, these are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. They're saying, it wasn't God, it wasn't Yahweh, Jehovah God, who brought us out of slavery. It was a golden calf. So there in the wilderness, Israel come to a place that is incredibly bleak. They come face to face through Moses with their own sinfulness. And God could have obliterated them in his anger, wiped them out, and created a new people from Moses. And Moses realizes that their sin actually goes even deeper than the golden calf, more endemic. He makes no bones of it. In verse 22 of chapter 9, at Taberah also, and at Massah, and at Kibroth Hataavah, you provoked the Lord to wrath. And when the Lord sent you from Kadesh Barnea, saying, go up and take possession of the land that I've given you, then you rebelled against the commandment of the Lord your God and did not believe in him or obey his voice. You have been rebellious against the Lord from the day that I knew you. Israel deserved judgment. They deserved to be abandoned by God and left to perish in the desert. But that's not what happens. And the Israelites discover something new. They discover in the wilderness that God is a gracious and forgiving God, and that his forgiveness is so deep that even the sin of the golden calf incident can be forgiven. My friends, never forget the lessons that you learn in the wilderness. Sometimes they're the most precious lessons that you'll ever receive. On the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, Jews pray a long prayer. It's called Al-Chet. It means for the sins. And they pray it 10 times. And it concludes with wonderful words, words that they found to be true in the wilderness. For you are the pardoner of Israel and the forgiver of the tribes of Yeshurun in every generation. And aside from you, we have no king who forgives and pardons. And I want to say to you this morning, aside from God, we have no king who forgives and pardons. So do you see three blessings that the people of Israel receive here in the wilderness? Firstly, they come face to face with the reality of their sin. You might think that doesn't sound like much of a blessing, but it is the most precious blessing we can have. To realize that we are sinners, we're in need of a savior, is the most precious gift. Secondly, they realize that they deserve nothing but death, nothing but condemnation. Thirdly, they finally understand God's faithfulness. Despite their sin, the promises of God hold true and they will inherit the promised land. And I have to say this before I come to my much shorter second point. This place that the Israelites have reached is one that every one of us must reach if we too are to inherit the promised land. For them, Canaan. For us, of course, heaven. We too have to confront our sinful nature, to acknowledge it and turn our backs on it. There's no way of entering heaven without realizing that we just don't deserve it, that we are utterly unworthy. And we have to ask the only King who forgives and pardons to take our sin away through Jesus Christ, his Son. That first step, acceptance of the fact that we really are sinners without hope of heaven, without hope of heaven on account of our own goodness, can be incredibly painful. It's a difficult moment, but it's one that we must meet. And the second thought is glorious beyond my capacity to accept, to express. Accepting the forgiveness only available because of Christ's atoning death on the cross is awesome, life-changing, eternity-changing. Guilt obliterating, blame annihilating, sin demolishing, death defeating, salvation bestowing, redemption is available only in Christ and not through our own good works or our efforts. Here's the thing. If the gift of the promised land had depended upon the righteousness of the people, they'd still be waiting to get into Canaan today. And if the gift of heaven depended on my or your worthiness to enter, we'd never get there either. It's all down to Jesus. We enter clothed in our righteousness because we have none, forgiven by the grace of God, deserving nothing, but receiving everything. Because of Christ. Let me move on quickly. These chapters make clear something rather unexpected. For years, as I said earlier, I've been saying, treasure the good times because they'll take you through the bad ones. Store up the lessons of the fat years because there may be lean ones to come. But Deuteronomy 8 and 9 turn that on its head. Treasure the wilderness. Learn the lessons they will bring to you. Remember them. Never forget them, because those very experiences will keep you safe in the dangerous times, the so-called mountaintop ones. So the first thing I want to say is this. When the good times come, when the mountaintop experiences come, when everything's going the way we love, then enjoy those times. Deuteronomy 8 verse 10 says, and you shall eat and be full, and you shall bless the Lord your God for the good land he has given you. So if everything is wonderful for you right now, great. Eat and be full. Enjoy the moment. Bless the Lord your God for the good land he's given you. Share your blessings with us so that we can rejoice with you. But Moses knows that those mountaintop experiences have hidden dangers, traps for the unwary, and he continues with a sobering warning. Remember, Never forget. Don't be fooled. Listen, he says, the good times are coming. God's promises are about to be fulfilled. For the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land, a land of brooks of water, of fountains and springs flowing out of the valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley, of vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive trees and honey, a land in which you will eat bread without scarcity, in which you will lack nothing, a land whose stones are iron and out of whose hills you can dig copper. And you shall eat and be full. The good times are coming. And not just that, but God is going to sweep the obstacles out of the way. Chapter 9, those giants, those Anakim. Oh, says Moses, you know about them, don't you? So do all the others. There's even a sort of proverb, who can stand before the sons of Anak? But you will know something greater, not by reputation, but by personal experience. So know this. Know therefore today that he who goes over before you as a consuming fire is the Lord your God. He will destroy them and subdue them before you. So you shall drive them out and make them perish quickly. But in all the expectation and the immediate promise of great times just around the corner, Moses brings his people back to earth, back to a sobering reality. Remember what you learned in the wilderness. Remember who you are. The easiest time to forget God is when everything is going well. That's a shock, isn't it? But it's true nevertheless. The easiest time to forget God is when everything is going well. When you start to depend upon your own strength. When you begin to forget the commandments of God and live your own way. And Deuteronomy chapter 8 makes it absolutely clear that if you stop obeying the commandments of God, the next thing is that you forget God. God's commandments are important. Beware, says Moses, oh, beware, beware lest you say in your heart, my power and the might of my hand have gotten me this wealth. In verse 4 of chapter 9, do not say in your heart, after the Lord your God has thrust them out before you, it's because of my righteousness that the Lord has brought me to possess the land. Verse 5, not because of your righteousness or the uprightness of your heart are you going in to possess the land. Remember what you've learned in the wilderness. Remember what you learned about yourself, about your sinful nature, but the goodness of God. You are chosen. And I'd say that to every person and to myself in this room today. You are chosen because of God's grace, not because you are in any way more worthy than anyone else. You are chosen by the grace of God. The trap of the mountaintop, of course, is to think that we got there by our own strength or virtue, and thus to fall. The joy of the mountaintop is to enjoy the view, unless like me you're scared of heights when you want to get down as quick as you can. The joy is to enjoy the view in the sure and certain knowledge that God brought you here because he loves you and cares for you more than you could ever possibly imagine. That without him, you'd never be here. And that no matter how high you are, how wonderful the view, or how convivial the company, he's got something even better, indescribably better, prepared and planned for you. There might even be more wilderness awaiting, but the final glory, the promised land, is promised. There's a clue in the name. And God never forgets his promises. The Israelites thought Canaan long promised them was glorious, but we are promised something far greater. Not because of our worthiness, but because of his. May the Lord bless you.